first got started. I remember that. And so it's taken us a while to get him to be a speaker, and I'm very happy that he is here today. Carl is a professor at the Faculty of Education, which I want to say has been a firm column in our building of the City Institute. It is remarkable how much we've done together, and we are continuing to do together between the City Institute and the Faculty of Education. So I'm very happy that also from that angle that we have this connection. He's himself the director of the York Center for Education and Community, YCEC, and he's also cross-appointed to two more graduate faculties in sociology and in social work. He holds a PhD in sociology and works on issues pertaining to educational and occupational access and equity for marginalized youth. Among other things, he focuses on the effects of suburban living on racialized immigrant youth and the role of sports in their schooling and educational attainment. His most recent publication, which is in press, is it updated? Is it still in press? Is Life at the Intersection, Community, Class, and Schooling. And today, Professor James is going to speak to us about growing up in the suburbs, the hidden cost of social mobility for the children of immigrant parents. Carl.
Thank you very much, Roger. Thanks for coming and thanks for inviting me. I want to talk about this move to the suburbs, and I have this big interest in what's the situation of young people when they go in the suburbs, and I'll tell you some of the sources and how I came to that shortly. But I want to start by giving a sense of what the suburbs mean, especially for parents, for immigrant parents or immigrant people. The suburbs means, for many immigrants, a place where you become represent social mobility. And of course, you see bigger houses, etc., etc. In the Toronto Star article, the Toronto Life magazine, and the New Suburbanites, Philip Prevelt gave four examples of families who sold their smaller houses in the city for more money and bought a bigger house in the suburbs for less money. He says they saw the benefits as more space, less debt due to smaller mortgage and therefore more money to invest, less noise, less general stress, a more relaxing commute despite longer distances. Travel is faster once out of the city. That's how the suburbs is represented to them. So the suburbs for many would be seen as a great place to live. Have your children grow up and build a sense of community. Nicholas Hume Brown sees the suburbs as conservative, bourgeois, and conformist, and many still have the whole concept of the white picket fence in the suburbs. Now, but today's suburbs, though, it's no longer as conceived as, especially with when we think of how people might think of the suburbs. There are lots of immigrants moving into the suburbs. They're moving out of the city. The influx of immigrants, we can see the second generation Canadians moving to the suburbs, as well as people who are just directly coming from elsewhere, immigrants. In a Globe and Mail article, Home in the Suburbs, Heart in the City, the author Francis Buller says, according to Metro Vancouver senior planner, Christina DeMarco, Vancouver, and she's referencing Vancouver. Vancouver stands out as a city where more of its suburban residents live in dense development of row houses, townhouses, and so forth. So certainly the suburbs is changing. And there's a greater push in developing are having other kinds of businesses in the suburbs. We need transportation and schools and so forth as in order to make the suburb much more accessible and much more responsive to the needs of the people who are moving there. Now, for immigrants though, and I'm going to be focusing on Caribbean immigrants in my discussion, it's what does the suburbs represent? Obviously, immigrants come to Canada with the idea of having to gain social mobility. So they look to the suburbs for better living condition, and it will be seen to them as a nice middle class area to go to. They think of it as, and I'm based some of my discussion on some work I've done growing up black in Oakville, and many of the research respondents that saw the suburbs, and at least Oakville, are saving their children from the barriers and negative stereotypes believed to challenge chances of success if they remained in the city. The belief that their children will share the same benefits that others in the community seem to experience, those who live in Oakville, and race matters less in the city, in Oakville, compared to racism and other things in Toronto, in the city. They're able to find environments that are more in keeping with their own values as parents. And of course, they thought of it having low housing costs. There are common notions of who lives in the city, and we think of many of these immigrants who think they're leaving the racial enclaves behind in Toronto and going to the suburbs, at least for Caribbean immigrants. And the type of things which typically characterize the inner city, they think that there would be no ghettos there and there would not be any high density living as they conceived it. And they think of their living crimes and violence and poverty behind. Accordingly, the move to the suburbs is based on the belief that these types of communities do not exist in the suburbs. They're going to have better living conditions. For example, in one of the comments from one parent in the study growing up in Oakville, the person, she said they wanted to live in a community that was not Scarlem, Scarborough, and Harlem together. They don't want Oakville to become like Little Mississauga. It's not that. They don't want more blacks, they say, but they want quality people. So that's what they expect. But of course, the suburbs is changing, as I said. So if we look at some research that was done by Mark Hume, talking about Asian immigrants in Richmond, looking at in Vancouver, it's a major growth and dramatic demographic shifts taking place in many of the suburbs in that area. It's becoming bigger and busier and more ethnically diverse. Like, for example, 80% of all recent immigrants coming from 5 countries moved to the suburbs there. And in a Global Mail article in 2006, looking at Toronto, Montreal, and Vancouver, 3 large cities, using the census data from 91, 96, 86, and 2001. More and more Canadians are now moving to the suburbs. Widespread demographic variation are across the suburbs. Suburbs are closely resemble cities when comparing these census, and suburbs are higher immigrant rates moving to the suburbs. Suburbs have larger proportion of racial minorities. For example, in the GTA, Brampton, it's alleged to have 40% racial minority, Markham 53%, Mississauga 47%, Richmond Hill 48%, and so forth. A Mississauga summit discussion on whether or not to introduce priority neighborhoods to the suburbs is based on the idea that poverty is less visible in the suburbs, but increasingly the poverty situation is taking place there. And the need for start looking at the poverty issues is something that's been raised. It's interesting that this has been talked about, these priority areas, when the Toronto City is wondering about should we maintain the whole idea of priority areas. What does that mean for us to have priority areas? A foundation study said housing costs and travel costs tend to increase as one moves away from the central areas of the cities, particularly from downtown Toronto. And they said to run the same house in the suburbs would cost $11,000 a year more in mortgage, property taxes, utilities and maintenance than a similarly valued house in downtown Toronto. Nevertheless, it's still seen as the attractive place for immigrants to go to. Am I going back or forward? Sorry. Yes, okay. So, when we think of transportation in the suburbs, then we have to think of the high cost of transportation. In a 1996 study, estimates that a family with one car living 50 kilometers outside of downtown Toronto spent $1,600 more a year on travel. For households with two vehicles, the annual cost raises to $58,000 more. And in another Globe and Mail article, in a recent Globe and Mail article, April 8th, The Home in the Suburbs, Heart in the City, the author says, he says, until recently, the suburbs have voted largely conservative, and he believes it's because they're short on time and money. What I run into is people who are exhausted, they don't get enough downtime or sleep time, they're driven to the suburbs in the first place because they think it's more affordable, they don't realize the time and the driving is going to cost them, they have no time to watch the national or read the newspaper, so when they do hear about an issue, they're angry. And that's what suburbs is making for them. So what we find in the suburbs today is family life in the suburbs is going to be different. We have families moving away from the networks in the city. Generational issues that will have to be contended with because of young people versus grandparents versus parents and all the different conception of the suburbs. And less access to social services and environmental costs. So, I'm basing what I'm going to say shortly on some of the work I've been doing. In 2003, I did some work on growing up black in Oakville, and I made reference to that already. It was looking at what black young people in that area thought of living in Oakville. There's some work that I've done as well in Mississauga. Once I interviewed five black youth who were basketball stars, and it was interesting of what they talked about living in the suburbs compared to in Toronto. And currently I'm working in Brampton in a school where we are working with Solemn. We're working at a school in Brampton. It's a new school. The school is just 2 years old now. And we have seen a number of issues going on in the suburb, in the school. We were brought to the school in the first place because teachers are very, very interested in getting parents involved in the life of the school, and they're having difficulties in doing so. So we're working in the school, working with kids and their parents in order to assist that process. And the next thing, is a recent movie.
We're seeing youth that live in nice homes, and they're not living in the ghetto. They're not living in the hood.
It's for black folks. That means you must not fight it.
But they're the ghetto mindset.
This is just a clip.
You know what he called me? He said I was whitewashed.
They said, Mom, if we play rugby, we'll be the ball.
Every time I said, we as black people, I'm always you guys cool with that? Is that right? Am I in the glove? What kind of jokes are you making?
You're so dark, you look like tar.
Oh, you're having a white woman.
Well, you didn't even do our normal thing, Doc.
You're so ghetto. All my graphic and political things are nuts. Yeah. Flower towers.
The brand new racists, they have black friends. But to the brand new racists, if you are not ghetto, then you are not black.
How do you know you're black?
How do I look? Because I look black.
There's no country called Black Lydia. You come up there and you're black.
Thank you for so sweet.
You have Viking blood in you. Is that on the nurse chin? Come on.
Are you denying your whiteness?
I actually use it when it's beneficial. Did I say that?
So you talk to me about how these people are so ignorant, but look at your report card. You are the stereotype. What kind of assumptions do you think people see if they see black?
Honestly, fear.
Anthony is someone who is
I don't fit the stereotype.
Fly with me, come on!
He's basically wanting us to finish what he did. I don't know why I like that so much.
Let every voice and sing to earth and heaven.
I'm trying to teach these kids what it means to be black because I don't really know myself.
That video is currently showing, I think it's showing at the TIFF right now. It's a suburban, it's really about suburban youth and this young man trying to work with these youth about sense of identity. So I'm going to identify the cost for young people growing up in the suburbs, black youth growing up in the suburbs. And I've identified four. Now, I'm hoping that we can have a discussion and it can go to more. But I said the context about some of the economic situations, social situations, so we can just simply move some of those situations to understand what it would cost for young people. So I identified four. The material cost, which I identify as really money and all those financial situation and implications. So material, clothing, and so forth. Social cost I see as relationships that young people might have with each other, with their peers, with friends, with family, and what's the implications of those relationships. The educational cost, the idea of schooling and what would that mean in the suburbs for young black youth. And I identify emotional or psychological costs as the sense of well-being or sense of self-esteem, self-confidence, and the things like that. The clip I showed you gave a sense of how these young people might be struggling with that sense of identity as well. So I would put that on the psychological cost. So the cost of living, while housing might be less expensive compared to the city, we have already identified a number of factors that families will have to put money into. And about a third of the youth that we interviewed in Oakville say that money is the only potential obstacle they had to their lives, to their social lives, and even to achieving their careers. As can be expected, their parent income affects the ability to fully participate in activities their peers take for granted, the school trips, the expensive clothes, and trips to the mall. I should also say, I probably was negligent to say so, while I identified all these four costs, and they seem, but they're not mutually exclusive, they're all interrelated, and of course, come together in various ways to influence the young people's lives. So I also think and see a number of the kids living in the suburbs might get a false sense of wealth of their parents' middle class, especially if the parents do not have the financial wherewithal to be able to take care of their financial needs. So we have talked with youth where the parents are not able to afford things, and they find it difficult to comprehend because the big house and all these other things to them might represent affordability, but that's not necessarily the case. The other point is the housing. We also know that there are a number of basement apartments being established in the suburbs. Christopher Hume reports in March 3rd, 2008 in Toronto Star, he says, "Downtown density will prevail over the slums of the suburbia." Just 3 weeks ago, a Scarborough couple was fined $10,000 for turning their home into a rooming house. So we can see that kids are not necessarily going to have all the facilities or access to their entire houses if the basements are going to be rented. The kids also will now have to live with and deal with the relationships between others who might rent out their spaces in their houses. Another thing too, extended families in houses will have implications for social relationships as well. And so these material things that will take place in these homes will have implications for young people and their growing up years. Another cost is transportation. In the suburbs, because of the density, housing density, the malls are not as accessible as if you can walk out and walk to the mall. Transportation, we understand, people will have to use cars to get from one place to the other. If the young people have to depend on parents to drive them, that's going to have access problems for them. So a number of these things will impact on their lives materially. The social cost. Parents are able to spend less time with their children. Social relationships, the kids lose their friends. In the studies that we did in Oakville, a number of the kids had originally lived in Toronto and they kept coming back to Toronto because they wanted to maintain their social relationships with their friends. Social services and social amenities and recreational facilities were not as accessible to some of these kids, and you can understand family relationships. Now, and we can understand too that in many of these cases, families, especially immigrant families, who have a concept of the suburbs, especially if you come from rural Jamaica and go to Beverly Hills, Kingston, you will have a very different sense of what the suburbs represent. And that's not translated in the Canadian sense. And parents and kids will have to negotiate those different perceptions of the suburbs and what it takes to live in the suburbs. One young person from Oakville said, "I talk to friends and they're like, I don't stay in Oakville, I chill in Mississauga or usually go to Toronto." One young man I talked to I can't say I ever really adjusted to living in Maple. Since moving here, I have not built in strong relationships with anyone. This is a part due to the fact that I spent a lot of my time back in my own neighborhood where we moved from. And his own neighborhood was Jane Finch. Educational cost. I make the argument that schools are not prepared for some of the kids who are coming into the suburbs and the suburban school. In growing up in Oakville, many respondents cited being one of few or only black young person in their classes in school. This was often a source of misunderstanding by others and led at times to feelings of alienation and loss of sense of belonging to the community. Teachers themselves, of course, are needed to adjust to the racial diversity that will be seen in their classes, and that becomes some of the, that provides certain kinds of professional development that teachers need and the tensions thereto. In a new class, it's almost like you have to prove yourself to the teacher that you are smart, that they don't believe you at first until you have the test in your hand. And this is one, and I'm giving quotes from some of the young people we talked to. At first, this used to bother me, white friends appropriating black culture and saying, I'm blacker than you are. But as I grew older, I learned there is more to being black than trying to do what we do. There is a struggle to being black youth in the suburbs. One of the big themes that came out in the work we did in Oakville is being singled out. Many of the young people thought that they were singled out by others. They were singled out and were stereotyped. They felt that they had to negotiate situations that they were not very familiar with. For those black youth who want to leave, reasons in why they wanted to move out of Oakville is because they found Oakville boring, and it was expensive for entertainment because it's only one area. They saw, as they put it, there was a lack of culture there, and they felt that they were racially profiled and they experienced racism and discrimination. So for them, returning to the city was very important for them to be able to have the social life that they wanted. So they saw this as having a significant impact on them and their lives. What is striking about the black youth who were growing up in Oakville is the primary reason they want to leave. They just didn't fit in. They're tired of having to defend who they are within a narrow social context, of not seeing themselves reflected in the landscape of their small town or the small city. One father was referred to as saying that they had to be ambassadors of blackness, of having to prove themselves to friends. One Yale professor puts it, they have to be the best blacks there is once they move to the suburbs. Black is just one aspect of your identity, one black youth said to us. It's a bigger ideal for others than for us. People don't look at black as part of an identity, look at it as who you are. White people have more options at the space to be diverse. They can be rich or poor, but blacks seem to only be able to fit into hip-hop, basketball, and other sports. One of the comments from one of the youth, the saddest thing is if a child is good at sports, they do not focus on academics, even you. They enjoy the positive qualities because you think you're stereotyping your child. That's a parent commenting. And then there's the other youth who talked about drugs and they're selling, and they were seen and expected to be the ones who would be into drugs, and they were not necessarily like that. I didn't know I was black until I came to Oakville. this was someone who moved from Jane Finch as well. In my school, Richmond Hill, students were, black students were the minority. Sometimes I wasn't used to going to school in Toronto. In total, there were approximately 10 black students in the entire school when I was in grade 9. And this is a school he was going to in Maple. It's the same youth that we... I felt that I was completely different from everyone else. It seems that the teachers and students already had their prejudgments about me before I got to know them or I got into the class. I also found it very difficult to make friends. Most of the other students knew each other already and built relationships. There was a sense of community that was not a, that I was not a part of. And here's how a parent reacts to some of the experiences. We as black parents, we survive here. We have to beat the white man at his own game. I tell my child that. They have to excel. They shouldn't forget that they're black. That for them to be comfortable, they have to work extra hard. I think all the time on this comment, because on one hand, parents are taking the child to the suburbs, and at the same time, they're understanding the difficulty. They're not understanding the realities that the child will have to deal with, and they expect the child to, quote unquote, work extra hard. But at the same time, the parents are saying to the kids in the same that you are the same as everyone else. So I want a discussion of all this, but I want to say a few points more here. So parents go to great length to give to the child, the children, a better life. The parents give the child a better life. They think that going to the suburbs will be an enhancement of the children's life and for them as well. They do not take into account the cost, that the social, economic, financial, and other costs to the children. And many of the children complain about this, that their parents do not understand them. And I think what it does, it produces a kind of tension between parents and children. Generational difference. And what I think here is not only the parents, the kids not understanding the parents in the Canadian context. So there are generational differences between the parents and the children. And there are differences based on region. So the parents will reference, say, the Caribbean and understand the Caribbean. The kids have no relationship or understanding the Caribbean in the same way that the parents had. So that's one problem they have to negotiate, the different generational differences. And the differences that the parents will think that this is the suburbs, this is a nice middle class life I've given to you, the child, and therefore you're supposed to enjoy it and accept it. And the children are sometimes pretty oblivious to some of the commitments the parents have had to make in order to afford them the lifestyle that they're enjoying. So there comes some of the difficulties that the parents and children will have to negotiate in the suburbs. So those are some of my comments, and we have some open for some discussion.
Thank you, Carl. Indeed we are. We have quite some time, so the floor is open.
Just a quick question. What's your involvement with that film? It looked quite beautiful.
I know the school that the film was made, and so that's the only relationship. We're doing some work in that very sort of school. But I have no relation. I only knew about the film recently.
Oh.
Yes, please.
I have a question. When we talked about educational costs, and as I was listening, see the cost of education, and you mentioned the need for professional development. I can see that. But I thought about curriculum. How does curriculum impact the cost of education? I am very distant from the Canadian education system. So I am throwing this question to just kind of hear where you're at. In terms of, do students feel alienated from the curriculum? How does the curriculum impact it? How does it draw their interest? So that they can relate to education. Is education meaningful to them?
On one hand, one of the things that parents think, and the research that has been done so far, is that what I can do for my child, I might not be able to have the financial resources to leave my child. So the parents will think that they're going to invest into education for the child. And the parents will expect that the child will go to school and learn, etc., etc. But then what we know is that the curriculum, sometimes others say they do not see themselves in the curriculum, or this curriculum is not responsive to their need. The parents, I think parents need to help that process. And parents do not make themselves available to schools in the same way in order to help that process. Now, how are the parents going to be able to do that if they're coming back from work at 7 or 8 o'clock at night because of the distance, compared to if they were living in Toronto? They might not be accessible to teachers who might want some kind of help and support in terms of curriculum and in terms of development of a curriculum that's responsive to the needs of the children. I think teachers in Toronto, because I know the Toronto board more than I know the suburban board, my sense of the suburban board is that there is a certain amount of expectation that teachers would have, because students are perceived to come from a middle class background and therefore will have access to some of these resources. I was at a meeting sometime last fall where the teacher were trying to expose kids to different kinds of opportunities, and the children were going to go to Montreal for French, etc. And it was a good curriculum experience. The parents were not able to afford that. And so the kids are left to, and teachers are left to try to negotiate some of those kinds of limitations that come out from living in the suburbs.
Kids who have moved from the urban Toronto areas are still left behind.
Yes, but again, if we take into account that there wasn't that financial situation that the parents had, they could see buying the house. And of course, the house is inexpensive. But all the other costs were not factored into, including the cost of raising the child in the suburbs, and the transportation costs and so forth.
So we have a lot of needs then. We have need for workshops and parent involvement.
Yeah, probably the need
might... It's a wide and vicious circle.
Yes, probably need might be to say, before you go to the suburbs, think about it.
And that's valid. You know, because what is the end product? Parents may not have the insight to see that, okay, finally, I'm seeing my child is going to be living in the suburb, in a nice home, that society says, well, we need to live in a nice home. But it is difficult as a parent to evaluate, look ahead, and forecast, okay, how is this going to affect the ultimate end product?
Yeah, I think about, so access to the library, for example, access to certain kinds of educational museum and all those kinds of things. Those need transport, which has cost, which parents might not take into account. But then they would argue that the the city doesn't seem that attractive either. You know, you might have access to the library, et cetera, et cetera. But remember, they're trying to escape what they see as the poverty, the violence, the kinds of stereotypes of their children. And therefore, if so, it's difficult to, one might seem much better than the other. But it's something, so it's something that not only the suburban parents must take into account, it seems as if we have to think about that generally in terms of living in the city.
And if we're not careful, then those kids have been in the syndrome.
Of course.
One of the things that strikes me as really interesting is the difference between the work you did in Oakville, the study you did in Oakville, primarily with black youth who are attending school that would be predominantly white, and your current stuff with Brampton, where youth would be attending schools that are actually predominantly South Asian, predominantly black. So while there's the similarities with the suburban experience, there's still going to be some significant differences in terms of student experiences there, I'd imagine.
One of the things I think about the work we're doing, I was in a meeting yesterday, or sometime, where there was a discussion about, is there any schools around that would have a significant black population, because somebody was trying to do some work around that. Oh yeah, we're doing some research and we're trying to make some comparisons between the Afrocentric school and other schools that might have a significant number of black students. And we could not think of any schools in the city. And of course, that would never be in the suburbs where there would be a significant number. There would always be a minority. But there have been schools, and there are schools. Like, for example, the school that we worked in Brampton would have at least 60, a number of schools in Brampton would have 60 and 50 and 40% South Asian. And the school that you saw there, Columbia, there are a number of black students going there, but that's a heavily South Asian school as well. So the students here are not leaving the suburbs and the urban area and going to the suburbs, you know, so that they're going to get the schools that's going to be predominantly responsive to them as black students. You know, there will be some work that had to be done with them.
Personal experience. I'm actually glad that my mom made a conscious decision, even when moving to Brampton from the Jane and Finch community, she made a conscious decision to rent instead of buying a home, where some people would argue that that's not a good thing. But she saw with a lot of her peers in our community, a lot of them would buy a house and would have to work two or three jobs just to afford the house, and they wouldn't have the time to spend with their children and their family. So I'm glad that she made that decision, because we didn't have that much of that type of a strain on our relationship. But going to some of the youth that I did go to school with in Brampton, you could see that, and it's good that you in the school that you're working in, you see that the teachers want more parent involvement. But there are teachers who take advantage, obviously, of students who don't have that type of parent involvement, where I've seen firsthand a lot of my peers, especially black men, black young men in school, who were taken out of the academic level and put right down into it was called the basic level in the school, for no apparent reason. And also for myself, with that quote where you have to work extra hard and prove yourself, I felt like I always had to prove myself to my teachers going to school in Brampton and compared to my experience in Toronto. And the final thing is, I don't think this policy is still around, but the zero tolerance policy, where a lot of my friends growing up, as soon as you turn 16, they were out of the school and put into like alternative schools. And it goes back to, I guess, the fact that the parents think, you know, we moved out of Rexdale, we moved out of Jane and Finch, we've escaped, you know, a bad life, but they go to these schools in the suburbs and they're still very marginalized. So I agree with a lot of the points that you brought up.
I should point out, in addition to that, Well, this school that we're doing in working with in Brampton is largely South Asian, significantly South Asian. And one of the issues we were brought in because parents were not visiting the school. And the teachers weren't. So it's not unlike the African Canadian parents or the Korean parents are not visiting school. So this is the same thing. So in one focus group hearing from Salem, one focus group where the kids, we asked the kids straight up, why, tell the story.
I think I know the story you want.
Well, why are you?
Well, because there's this big focus on parental involvement, and the teachers and the principals and vice principals really want to encourage it, and are quite confused why they hold all these events and our parents aren't showing up. The funny quote, when he asked about this in the focus groups, one of the students...
Of students.
Sorry?
Focus group of students.
Yeah, focus groups with students. Among a lot of other responses that all kind of revolve around this, one of the students said, well, that's what white parents do.
The suburbs and parents in the suburbs and these immigrant parents are not necessarily there with all the social capital or understanding life in the same way they assumed that they would understand life. And the kids have a very different perception.
Yeah,
and the kids just love the fact that their parents don't come to the school.
Yeah, it doesn't bother the kids.
They don't want their parents to come to the school.
And there are two notions surrounding that. One, like people were saying, their parents are visiting, their parents often don't get home until 7 or 8 at night. But then the other thing was, a lot of their parents, they assume that if everything's going well, they won't hear from the school, so they'll hear from the school if there's a problem.
It's true.
It's true.
But don't you think there's some historical perspective to that? You're coming from places where, as a kid growing up in Jamaica, my parents never had to go to school. They just given that you did what you told and you were going to learn. So I find as a teacher here, it was difficult to get parents to come. It's almost like you have to educate them that in this system, we need to see you. You need to come in so we could talk. But where we're coming from, it wasn't a given that you run to school.
I would even say that it's a generation question. Where I come from, my parents never went to school, and I don't think parents in Toronto of a generation ago would go to school the way some parents go to school now. I think it's very much has something to do with the development of the family. Philip.
Yeah, hi, Carl.
Hi. I
wondered if you had any sense of how post-school transitions into the labour market are affected by the move to the suburbs. In a housing market like the whole of the GTA, a resource that young people often have to use is staying with their parents into their 20s and even longer. Do you have any sense of how a move to the suburbs then affects their ability to access the labour market after school?
I'm not sure, but one of the things that I should have also made mention too is getting into the labor market means also being trained before, like, for example, access to part-time jobs, which is sometimes is a scarce resource in the suburbs because of transportation, because of all these kinds of things. And therefore, my sense, I haven't followed up with any of those youth, so I have no sense of the access to these jobs. But I know they complain about not having part-time jobs in order to take care of some of their needs. And so I would assume that competing for jobs for after leaving high school would be quite difficult, especially when you're competing with people who have been working part-time in some of these jobs in Toronto. And again, they would have to travel to get to these jobs.
One of the issues I'm talking from personal experience. When I came to Toronto, I was in Scarborough, and my experience was a lot of the points that you brought up today. But when I moved to Richmond Hill, it was a lot different because I was, I guess, blessed that we moved in at a time where there were a lot of houses being built. So when we moved in, even though it was like in grade 10, grade 11, there were like 40, 80 new kids that came in. So we became like a new group. But I guess a lot of the youth need, I mean, it's unfortunate, but I mean, I had the opportunity to be able to make that transformation and learn from what happened with me in Scarborough and improve on it so I don't get those, you know, negative comments again.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess, you know, just having the choice makes it a lot easier, but I mean, it's not always the case. If people are born there, they're usually raised there. They go to it, they have no option. But yeah, I wish a lot of people could do that and improve on themselves too.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you did any research on, like, because I came from the Caribbean, straight out of high school. I didn't go to high school here. So I was wondering if you did any research with immigrant children who come straight from high school in Jamaica to high school here, and how they react to that, because in Jamaica it's very different. You wear uniforms, you're very regimented, disciplined. You can't say a bad word, else you get a demerit, suspension, and kicked out of school. But up here, so they get to leave school and go buy food. We couldn't do that, else you get expelled. So I'm wondering how do people, if you have done anything like that, where they come here and it's a different, it's more freedom compared to Jamaica.
I've done some work in that, but what I want to pick up on what you said in terms of the discussion. You see, that's what parents who move to the suburb, immigrant parents, that's a sense of their expectation of the child. You know, that discipline they would expect because they come out of that kind of a situation where that discipline is what they practiced and they took to. But so, and therefore, that's why the parents don't feel they don't need to go to school,
yeah,
because
in Jamaica, your parents don't come to school because it's so disciplined. If you do one thing wrong, they'll tell you. But and the teachers act as your parents because they'll spank you, and you know they don't give you detention. You get spanked. They don't give you detention and don't give you time out. So the parents trust their children with the teachers, and they talk to the teachers. But sometimes they'll come in the parking lot and talk to the teachers and stuff like that. So you don't come to school. You don't come to school on a regular basis unless it's really necessary.
Yeah, and so do you see? This is what I'm arguing. Then this is the culture of the parents in the suburbs, and not necessarily the parents who are third and fourth and fifth generation Canadians who have had a middle class kind of a cultural capital where they see. They have to be in school in order to control what the students are getting. Warren.
Well, I'm going back to the parent part because I mean the research will suggest that one of the big things about parent involvement is that this is how information flows. Parents who are connected to school get the best information that parents can use to better help their children. And I was thinking about this in relationship to something you said about these parents who move to the suburbs. They often communicate to the children, rightly or wrongly, a false sense of the wealth or the class location of the family. Often moves to the suburb brings with it a better life, but also brings with it excessive financial burden. It requires the parents to work longer and travel further to work, and therefore they can't participate in the life of the child as much as they might like. But I'm wondering what it might mean to compare this with sort of white Anglo-Saxon parents who has a different kind of class location. Parents who can participate in school often can participate because they have time. These are flexible jobs, or they're stay-at-home mothers, or there's other capacities that the family has for the parent involvement. So I'm wondering about this aspect of false class location. What do you know anything about the relational class position of these families relative to other suburban families? And might that contribute to the capacity of families to participate in school, make school visits, go to parent-teacher meetings, be involved in the school in various ways, and so on. I wonder if this really has something to do with the false class location of the kind of families that we're talking about, who have an outwardly looking sense of middle classness, but don't have the middle class freedom that often comes with middle class life. Flexible work, stay-at-home mothers, lots of spare time to do different kinds of things.
Yes, I would say that that's the case. And the parents might not have the access, and the children might just simply feed off the fact that the parents do not have the time or put in that support. On the other hand, though, there's another part that we need to think about, especially for some of these Black Caribbean parents and kids, actually. There's a sense of, and what we've found in the literature, even though they're in the suburbs and they're having all these difficult lives, a number of these kids always feel a sense of obligation. Somehow they feel they need to live up to the expectations of their parents, and therefore will apply themselves despite the fact that they might not like what the fact that their parents might not be able to support them the way they do. And they see, as in some of the research we found, that some of the kids feel that they should do their best in order for them to be proud of, for their parents to be proud of them. And they feel that it's in their interest and for their parents, but also there's a sense of they're doing it for, quote unquote, the Black community. As I said earlier there, where they talked about, I represent, or I have to do this so that I do not fit into the stereotype. One of these kids that was living in Maple, in the interview he did with me, he kept talking about, my mom didn't want me to be a statistic. And statistics would mean getting into problems, crime, etc. But equally, not growing up to be a Black male, that's not working and productively. So even though they might not have the resources and access to all these kinds of things, the other factors that play a significant role in their lives that might make them successful. And for the parents, probably that's what the parents pass on. Probably we need to start thinking of class differently. The parents might pass on the idea of, you know, you have to do it for me. And kids pick up on that.
So rather than passing on the class, it's passing on the idea of class.
I'm really interested in suburb groups, particularly families. I'm just thinking of my own experience and some people that I grew up with. And I grew up in Scarborough, and a lot of people in my class, they would move to the outer suburb, so outside of City of Concord, into what are now forming as ethnic offices. And I'm wondering...
What to know what? Oh,
particular groups. And I'm wondering if moving into a more sort of conscious social group, even though it is in the suburbs, as a way to sort of counteract some of the social costs, educational costs, and emotional, psychological costs, because you're amongst similar communities, but also as a way to sort of negotiate between this sort of ideal suburban life and lived reality, and perhaps those types of ethnic clusters of families and groups, a response to this sort of disconnection.
Mm-hmm. That might be so, and I think for some groups that can happen when you get in these enclaves. But for other groups, it might not, because they might not have that significant numbers in order to form the enclave. But I have another point when I think of that, though, is young people today, the generational difference might not, you know, so parents might move because they think it's going to be in the best interest of the kids to live in the enclave. But the kids do not necessarily grow up with those same concept of being Chinese or being Asians or South Asian or being African, etc. Because they grow up in a different time, a different space, and have different relationships to identities. And they imagined, as I always think of the Caribbean, these kids might imagine a Jamaica that doesn't exist, you know, and when they go back there to visit, they come back with a very different sense of, because they were there as tourists for 2 weeks, etc. So yet, even though those enclaves might exist, the kids do not necessarily feel a great affinity to that kind of connection. We're not sure, but that's still something to be thought of.
I think a lot of the times, it's also the parents that when they come, because I know from the South Asian background, parents don't, even though they're in Canada, they still think of back home as their home, and they think of those ideals as more appropriate. That I guess has an issue. I mean, when my parents came here, they said this is their home, so they started adapting to the culture here. I guess that made it a lot easier for me to adapt to Canada as well, because I wouldn't have that struggle where you're talking about back home and then, you know, you're comparing the two. So I think even to get parent involvement is for them to accept this place a little more if they, or wherever they are staying, to identify back.
But do you think it's very easy for parents, though? Because
not at all. Because they spent 30, 40, 50 years maybe back home. My parents have moved 3 countries, so it's a little different.
We have behind my back, I have to take these first because only sort of shadows at the hand.
Sorry.
So let's go in the maybe the three in. Let's, can we bundle those questions and then respond, and then it's your turn. Sorry, but I might have not seen you earlier.
Okay, I think I missed the first presentation, but anyway, I tried to get the main point. Thank you, Carl, for doing this kind of presentation. Even if the research is based on only on Caribbean communities, as an immigrant, I could relate myself. When I say I relate myself, I'm the mother of 3 children, older children, and moved from the urban to the suburb, the issue is the same, whether you are from Caribbean or not. But when I look at it, why I moved from the urban to suburb, it's not about the pulling factor of the suburb, but the pushing factor of the urban life. Because I couldn't afford to buy a house. And the safety of my children was so important to me. So because of that, I went to the suburb. But when I look at the suburb, the pulling factor of the suburb, it's not there. I don't have the social network. Let's say if I want my kids to take them to swimming pool, whatever, I can't take them because I work in Toronto and I don't have time to do this kind of thing. All those kind of issues are there. But you know where I really want to highlight is about the school. And I don't think it's about parents, but I think as a society there's a big problem. Where I live, it's very homogeneous society, community. My kids always have to prove who they are. It's not about me. When they were in elementary school, they didn't have any problem. They have from different races, language, they had friends. As soon as they put their feet on high school, there's a black group, Asian group, you are brown, you are white. They have to choose either or. I think this is not only about parents. It's not about my kids. I talk to my kids. Why are you, you know, you've been friends with so-and-so. Why are not your friends now? They were saying they're not our friends anymore. Everyone is going to his own. It's sad to hear this kind of things. And they happen in the suburb most of the time. So that's why it's not about the pulling factor. But when I look at the cost and benefit, the benefit of moving to the suburb is really good to my family. Yes, of course, it has economic cost. Yes, it has a social cost. But when I outweigh, it's better for my children. I think as a parent, that's how I see. You know, we have, but to me, teachers have to be aware because our kids shouldn't improve or prove always who they are. You know what?
because of their color, they shouldn't be put in that position. You know, my kid, I do have a son when he drives a car, and always he has to stop by the police. One day he was waiting for his dad, and the police came and approached him. What are you doing?
This is in the suburb?
In the suburb. You know, those kind of things, of course, it's not the pulling factor, but what choice you have.
Mm-hmm.
So, as a society, it's a structural problem. Whether you are white, black, Asian, I think we have to see this as a problem. And we have to work toward that. You know, it's not only the PD for the teachers. I think as a society, we have to work to do that.
Thanks.
Did you
want
to comment?
Yeah, I just wanted to go back to the parent and teacher interviews, and I wanted to know if there's like repercussions for the students or the parents if they don't actually get involved in that way, because I know there's this idea if the parents don't show up or the parents aren't involved, then the teacher puts less effort or support into that child. So have you seen that in your studies?
I don't know. I can only talk about Toronto in this case, but because the school that we're working in, the teachers are very, very keen on the students, and so that school, we cannot say that to be the case. And the suburban schools we work in, but certainly in the Toronto area, there are. But also, it has to do with the ease with which teachers feel that they can communicate with parents too. And that becomes something to take into account. But I would not
say something as somebody who has taught for 30 years, and mostly in Jane and Finch. If I speak for my own self, and I would think maybe 20 years ago when I taught at Fairgrove and parents weren't even coming the way they're coming now, I would never in a million years say, well, because the parent didn't come, then, you know, you get less of me. I just don't think that, for me anyway, and I would think for many of my colleagues, I don't think that was an issue. I think the work was, we worked really hard to really try to get parents in to find interest in innovative ways of doing it. But I don't think we would say, well, because your parents not come, then you get less of
me.
No.
Absolutely. There was one more here. No, one more here first, and then back there, and then we can go over here.
I think it's good that you're a teacher who, does that. But I've seen firsthand there are teachers who do exactly what Jessica's pointed out, where they see there is... let's say the parents not involved, and they just don't take the extra time and the extra care. Maybe it's something to do with the suburbs versus Toronto, but I've seen that. And back to add to what I was saying before is my mom actually came here when she's 3 years old from Jamaica, so she didn't have necessarily those types of values that you're talking about, where it's like the teacher does everything and they just leave it in their hands. Where I just wanted to say that she would come into the school and advocate for me, and I feel like, and I know that if she didn't, I wouldn't have been in university, because there are a lot of setbacks and pullbacks along the way, and if she didn't have that careful, watchful eye, then it probably would have led to other implications. But I just wanted to ask you, like, with the parent involvement, do you see a difference with race sometimes, where possibly... I think he's your student. He pointed out that only the white parents come to school. One of the students in the focus group said that only the white parents come to the schools. Do you find that there's a difference between, let's say, white and black parents when they do come to the school? Is there a difference between their relationship with the school? Because my mom's stance personally with the school was one that was very firm, that she's kind of saying, I know what's going on type of thing. Whereas do you think in the white community it's more... let's get involved with school,
doing
fundraisers,
or
that sort of thing.
I think I would push race less and put class more in that respect. again, it's the time that the families have to be able to go to school, the kinds of opportunities they have, the kind of relationship, the kind of command, etc., I think. So I would really think class would be a factor in this respect, and not just simply race.
Question. I was interested in this idea, what central in these parents is this transmission of obligation, of this move is being made to provide maybe even just a perception of class mobility or social advancement. I'm interested in how that gets taken up by the young people, just as perhaps translating as an obligation, but maybe in some ways as a burden, as to see how that may have weighted upon the performance of these students as they have to try part-time jobs, perform academically, please aspire parental expectations of middle-class educational expectations. So I was wondering about that, and maybe not even, you know, how that might be perceived in mental health or as a weight. First, and then second, to the question of, I guess, labor market, do we see a trend of these young people staying at home longer? So I think maybe you might have been working with students under 18, but does that seem to, into their 20s, late 20s, early 20s, are they staying at home more living in this, because this class transmission is not, maybe it's just a perception of class, so how do they transmit that? So I just wondering.
I like your first question, if that could have that implication for the kids, because the parents have provided them this middle class lifestyle, quote unquote, and the kids might feel an obligation, and the parents might guilt them into feeling that. But on the other hand, I'm not sure about kids stay at home longer, because all kids are staying at home longer these days. But I'd say here, though, it might be a different implication for some of these parents who live in the suburbs, because insofar as the kids' income might be what's needed in order to help support the families in these places.
You wanted to?
Oh, yes. So I'm very interested in this idea of the immigrant drive, or like you were talking about, this push that they have to work extra hard. So I'm wondering about the relationship between this push to work extra hard versus the access within the schools to actually attain that ideology, and you know what happens when you know they're not able to. So I'm very curious about that in terms of what we've been.
When the kids are not able to succeed.
Mm-hmm. Like when those opportunities aren't available for them.
You see. When the opportunities are not available for them, again, I keep thinking they might feel, they might look at the individual, you know, like, I did not work hard enough, probably I did not make it, I did not. It's all going to be seen as individual, not the institutions. In some cases, they might see it as institutional, like the teachers didn't do their job again, but do not see it as a large institution. And parents themselves might not even have the language or the background in order to assist the child to do the kind of work that's necessary or analysis so that that they make it. So it's a problem that these young people, and so that's why we see in some cases the alienation, the lack of sense of making, how to make it in their life. And probably that's some work that these schools have to do, which is going to be different from the urban schools.
Simon.
Carl, your research team might know about this, but the cluster of schools in Northwest Brampton, St. Emmett Campion, Fletcher's Meadow, which you mentioned, there was this myth or narrative that emerged for a few years that the reason there was black migration to Northwest Brampton, this was among administrators, white teachers and police officers, that it was TCHC, the Toronto Community Housing, was relocating as Regent Park went under revitalization.
they were relocating Regent Park's population to Northwest Brampton.
Yeah.
And then that became dominant for explaining, for framing any time a black student got into trouble.
Yeah.
It was explained on, oh, this is the Regent Park migration. This is bringing the city to the suburb.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
What do we know about the boards, the suburban boards? And from what I know is that the Dufferin-Peel Catholic School Board and whatever the public regional board is, there didn't intervene to counteract this narrative. And it got to the point where the mayor of Brampton had to write something in the Brampton Guardian to say this was actually a myth.
And the mayor had to say it's a myth. The mayor also had to say, had to put the chief of police up to say he also came from a working class area and see how much he has achieved, etc., etc. This is only about 2004 or 2005 years ago this happened in Brampton. The idea was that people were able to now buy, the government was giving people $5,000 to put down on a house in Brampton in order to ensure that they live or move out of the city. And a number of them, they were not only from Regent Park though, a number of them were seen as coming from Jane Finch. And a significant number of Brampton actually, Fletcher's Meadow, are people who have moved from Jane Finch. But the movement has been from Toronto to Malton to Fletcher's Meadow. So it's not, sometimes it's not direct.
So did the board do anything to counteract that narrative?
No.
It didn't?
No. Only the city did something in order. But you see, it also happened in the summer months when this was quite a burning issue at that time.
Well, just a question about, let's call it return migration, whatever. I mean, assuming that many parents realizing the cost, social cost, material cost. I mean, is there any evidence of moving back
to the city? No. You see, I still think the idea of social mobility I've talked with people who will say if they live in a 2,000 square feet house and I live in a 1,000 square feet house downtown Toronto, there's no comparison, you know. You have a big house, and you have so that whole construction of what that represents is still very alive and well. So moving back it's also interesting because we see people moving to the suburb, to the city from the suburbs, and moving into condo houses. But they're certainly not immigrants necessarily or racial minorities.
I have a question about the, you draw a line in the sand between the city and the suburbs. You do it in terms of housing form, you do it in terms of municipality jurisdiction, you do it in terms of school board jurisdiction, you do it in terms of sort of the general images we have in mind when we talk about the suburbs. But Jane and Finch is also the suburbs. So, I mean, they used to be the suburbs. And so when people move to Jane and Finch to Northwest Brampton, it doesn't necessarily mean they're moving to the suburbs. It's really what I think you said, suburban to suburban migration. So I'm curious about whether some of what the parents and the students experience has nothing to do whatsoever with whether it's urban or suburban, but it has, I mean, it as an explanatory mechanism, it doesn't work for me yet, and I have to think more about it. You know, that's one thing. The other thing is that I think there's a profound insecurity generally about the school system, which was perhaps best expressed in the experience from the Jamaican school, which is regimented, and the Canadian schools on the other hand. But there's a lot of in between. My experience as an immigrant parent who has no clue how Canadian, and that I'm married to a woman who grew up in yet another country. We are completely clueless as to how to school our kids.
We're somewhere in the middle, you know, from the between the regiment. My wife was in a convent for a while, so you know, it tells you where things can come from and where you go. But what we experience is in the school that there's, you know, there's the individual parents. Some of them, they may be white, maybe middle class. But what we experience is there's a lot of organizing of parents going on in the schools. And there are people calling each other and ganging up on particular teachers, or ganging up on particular principals who are not getting the drug problem under control, or they're not stopping the bullying. So they organize, and that is different from sort of the knee-jerk parental reaction of one individual parent protecting their child. Then it becomes sort of a group effort, which then has completely different social dynamics that, you know, we are completely unused to as immigrant parents. We have no idea how to react to that. We're staying out of this completely, actually. And I find that, I'm just using that as an example to say there's a lot of insecurities, and none of them necessarily have to do whether I live downtown. It doesn't have anything to do with whether you live downtown or in the suburbs. It has more to do with a general insecurity about levels of expectations on all sides, the students, the parents, the teaching apparatus, the state apparatus that provides all these things. And I, you know, I wonder whether, you know, you can explain how you see the urban-suburban split has an explanatory value directly to explain these insecurities.
Yeah, certainly it's not just purely these geographies, urban-suburban, but people make put social meanings to these things. So if I move to Brampton and I see this as a suburb, that becomes a social construct that I'm going to use, or people from those particular backgrounds are going to use it because it represents something. Then if I was living in, say, for example, downtown Toronto or Jane and Finch, while Jane and Finch and these other areas and Malvern might have been seen as suburbs at one point, there were certain constructs and thought about those areas that people would have used and also contribute to those compared to moving out. And I'm seeing that as immigrants then, there's certain kinds of constructs they understand in the city and the outer part of the city for them, and therefore they're using them accordingly. So I'm saying then the suburbs then, in relation to a social construct that they're constantly trying to understand, and they see that as a construct that would represent certain kinds of class mobility.
Yeah, thanks.
But I think one of the things that Roger is saying is that maybe the constructs of urban and suburban are not static.
Oh, absolutely.
Because you said this in your presentation, that parents who from what they might consider to be the city, and they move to the so-called suburbs, and then the same, you know, the suburbs become the city again. And these are certain issues. And, you know, I'm just wondering, here we might begin to wonder what's new. I was thinking of you know, the play and the movie Raised in the Sun, where the younger family decides to integrate. This is in the 1950s. Move from downtown Chicago to integrate a white suburb, and the cost of that within the family. And for example, my own experience, I grew up in New York City, you know, the Caribbean families who started families in the 40s and 50s in Harlem and Brooklyn, they would move to Queens or they'd move to Wyandanch in Long Island or something like that. And all of those places were the suburbs in the 50s, but by the 60s, they were inner city again. So it seems that this is a very dynamic movement, and in terms of it, shift very quickly, such that the three kind of explanatory variables that we might see as static become less powerful or less robust in terms of trying to explain the kind of thing. So I'm wondering how we build that into doing the kind of research when things are moving so fast.
Yeah, and once I went to Brampton to and what I find is people moving away from, you know, so Brampton eventually might be seen not as quote unquote the suburbs, but Orangeville, and so certainly I appreciate that dynamic is taking place. Whereas some people are talking about the suburbs, the urban now in the suburb, in urban suburbs, etc., etc. Certainly, I'm not oblivious to this dynamic, but of course, there are certain constructs that people are using in terms of how we're going to align ourselves to where we live.
There's actually, in that article you first cited in the Toronto Life article, one of the major criticisms that was made of this article was that the guy actually wrote from Uxbridge or someplace. So some people said, you're not actually writing about moving to the suburbs, you're actually writing about moving to another small town in which you have all the services that you would have in Riverdale or in the beaches, but you just have them in Uxbridge. There is a Starbucks, there's this, there's that. So there is that other thing also happening, and I was wondering whether Oakville was a place like that. It's a really, you know, it is also a town, right? It also has its own logics. And Brampton, of course, and Markham, they're all different, and they have different ways of integrating communities and the mix. I'm very intrigued by this idea that the kids are moving, when they move to high school, that they're all moving to these groups. And I wonder whether these different towns and suburbs deal with that kind of grouping differently, because I've also seen that in my kids, you know, the moment they get to that age, all of a sudden they split, like, you know, there's magnetism of some sort, and I don't actually understand, you know, whether the social community in which you are has an influence on how the schools deal with this diversity.
Of course, and the familiarity, I think, of that community with that diversity, it's going to influence how it's dealt with. But what it says, though, is that whether they're living in the city or they living outside of the city, wherever, that kind of dynamic is going to be realized based on these identity issues that people are working with.
Fascinating. Thank you. Before I'm asking you to join me in thanking him again, Carl, again, let me give you a couple of announcements. One is, outside of our regular pattern of city seminars, we have a city talk, smaller format, more flexible, but nonetheless extremely interesting and important. Adoma Patterson, who is a specialist with the Peel Region Poverty Strategy, Human Services, the region of Peel, will speak to us on, does poverty exist in Peel Region? More on the suburbs, and it is from 12 o'clock. This time it's 12 o'clock, not 12:30. We apologize for the mix-up today. But that time on the 16th of February, which is a Thursday, not a Friday, Thursday, 12 to 1:30 in this room on the 16th of February. But there will be announcements sent out. Our next regularly scheduled city seminar is in a month time. This is on Friday, March the 2nd. Also in this room, and that's going to be John Van Nostrand, a planner with Planning Alliance, talking about planning and unplanning Toronto and in the far future, not so far. I just emailed with him today, and we will soon have a title. Last city seminar of the year, it's going to be Sean McCullough of Spacing Magazine, who is going to speak to us on March the 30th from 12:30 to 2. And that is going to be in the HNES building in FES. So keep your eyes peeled for those announcements. In the meantime, let me thank Carl for a wonderful talk. And I wish you all a great weekend, and I'll see you all again. Thanks.